Siren 107.3 FM. Also, in association with southsidebroadcasting.com, bringing you the midweek drive here, because frankly, you deserve the very best, dear listener, and continuing our line with respect to the very best, and our coverage of the Middlesbrough Literary Festival. A young lady who... We started off actually today with Tim Moulton, and we looked at 101 things you thought you knew about the Titanic but didn't. Benita Brown, obviously, looking at literature in the 1940s from a fictional perspective and so on. And we're kind of back in the 30s here, because and the 40s, because if we talk about the 1940s house on Channel 4, and of course the Edwardian country house, I think it's fair to say, Malcolm, that we could only be referring to a historical consultant extraordinaire whose name might be
Juliet Gardner.
Are you there, Juliet?
Hello, yes.
Good to touch base with your good self, Juliet, and welcome to the good ship Siren. I think I'll hand over straight away to Malcolm for questions you might want to put to Juliet about the 30s, colon, an intimate history.
Yeah, goodness me, what fascinating topics. Now, also, what's caught my eye, Juliet, in your little sort of brief synopsis of what you're going to be doing at Middlesbrough on Thursday, 8th of July, you talk about writing the accompanying book to the film of Ian McEwan's novel Atonement. So what is that exactly?
Do you know they actually filmed part of that on Red Car Beach?
Yeah, I do. The big Dunkirk scene.
The big battle scene, precisely.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Red Car Beach, can you believe it? Must have been freezing.
There we are. Yeah.
But well, quite a lot. I mean, I didn't write any book. What I did was I was a historical consultant, because obviously a film is very different from a book. And most films or most television, big television series, which are set in, you know, in the past in some way, usually have somebody to advise them on what's sort of authentic and what's right for that particular period. So that's what I did for Atonement.
So you did that on the film?
Yes. Well, yes. You sort of talk to the actors about what you know, what the period was like. You get them to read books, so they've got some idea, and then you usually go on set, or they ask you questions about, you know, would they have been doing this? Would they have been doing that? What might they have worn? How would they have cleaned their knives?
So I can just briefly interrupting there, Malcolm, but I have to ask the question. That Keira Knightley, was she a keen researcher, or did she just say, I can't be doing with this, I'm going by method?
I have a photograph of Keira Knightley very kindly reading one of my books. So
excellent.
In Hyde Park with her boyfriend.
There we are.
So did she and James McAvoy consult you sort of quite heavily about...
They didn't directly. Well, they did. I mean, we had a long talk. We spent time talking before they... Yeah. Filming, but after that it would be the production people. They might ask the production people, and then, you know, they might say what would have happened or something. Mainly it was the production people who would ring me and say things like, would Big Ben have been silenced, because of course all church bells were silenced in the war, so they wondered if Big Ben would have been, that sort of question. So it wasn't actually the actor, though the actor sometimes obviously would ask a question, and then production would bat it to me.
And do you enjoy all that?
Oh, yes, I like it very much. I mean, often you get completely nonplussed because you get asked something. I mean, I've done it several times now, and you get asked something which you don't know, and you have to go beetling off to a museum or a library and, you know, or an archive and try and find out. But, I mean, a lot of the questions, obviously, you know, you do know, but not everything, because people are very detailed and very obscure questions sometimes.
What's the most ridiculous question you've been asked?
I don't think I have been asked this question. I've been asked detailed. I don't think I've ever been asked something silly. You know?
Well, I have to say that the 5-year time period you spent as editor of History Today, it was probably the finest period of that magazine's publication.
Oh, that's fantastically generous.
Well, I only call it as I see it. Joy. Questions for Juliet.
Hi, Juliet. I have to say, I think it's... I absolutely love historical homes and... Well, I just love architecture and houses. It must be such a fascinating area to be involved in. When did your passion for houses begin?
Well, it wasn't... It's not so much for houses. I mean, I am very interested in houses. I'm very interested in architecture. I love it. But what I'm really interested in, I suppose, is how people lived and how people lived. I mean, houses are tremendously important. How we live now is very much influenced in a way by where we live, the sort of houses we live in, the location we live in, and all that sort of thing. I mean, in a way, I think it... I mean, I've just always loved architectural detail, design, interior design. That's my sort of... you know, visual interest and my hobby, I suppose, really. So when I was asked to do, the first one I was asked to do was the 1940 house, I just leapt at it. I absolutely loved it and, you know, have gone on from there. Really.
And what was particularly distinctive about the 1940s house?
Well, of course, it wasn't. It's interesting, really, because it wasn't really the 1940s house. Nobody's was, because, of course, in the Second World War, you couldn't buy furniture. You had to have a permit to buy furniture. And the only people who were allowed to buy furniture were those who had been bombed out. In other words, they had lost their furniture. Or young married couples setting up home for the first time, you know, were allowed to buy a small new sort of utility furniture. So what we were really looking at was a sort of 30s furniture. Mm. And what's always very interesting, it's just like today. I mean, people's houses are a bit of a mishmash of styles. I mean, I'm sure in your home you've probably got, you know, some brand new IKEA things or whatever, and you've got some, you know, a few things you've inherited, perhaps your parents, or you bought at a, you know, a car boot sale, all that sort of thing. And you know, the 40s house was sort of very much like that. It reflected the eras that had gone before, but it very much reflected really the 1930s. And as far as I'm concerned, the 1930s are the high point of architectural and design in every sense. So
I live in a house that was built in 1935, and I just think it's an absolutely beautiful house. The way every room sort of has a function, you know, and spacious rooms. I really like that about the style of houses then.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the modernist houses in the 30s, I mean, obviously there weren't very many of them. You had to be fairly rich to have them. I mean, that's what's so interesting about the 30s, I think, in terms of architecture. You had such a variety of styles. You had these wonderful, you know, things that looked like, I don't know, they looked like ocean liners. TB sanatorium, and a lot of them, of course, were designed by German or Austrian emigre architects who had come over here, you know, thrown out or fleeing from Nazi Germany or Austria. And then, of course, you had the great suburban development at that period, and of course, they were very, very different. I mean, on the whole, people who lived in those sort of houses didn't want flat roofs, they didn't want crittle windows, they wanted what we would regard, I think, now as very, I think they were usually called Tudor Beeth, and, you know, they had sort of fake beams on the outside. Yeah. I'm sure you've got lots around you. I mean, there's still masses of them.
Julie, it's the very notion of fakery and Lincolnshire. Surely, I mean, it's an outrageous slur. Really. Almost as bad as suggesting that the Swedish manufacturer is providing flat pack furniture. You always lose the last kind of the key that's there. That's a different line entirely. Judith, as somebody who's had extensive experience performing artists from obviously Edwardian times, and indeed many of your musical routines were based, I suppose, originally in Edwardian times. Questions from yourself?
Well, I just think it must be very interesting for you researching it all. I can almost hear Al Boley records playing in the background there for your 1930s stuff.
Lovely, yes. You know, absolutely. Al Boley, wonderful. And Jack Ken, Snake Hips Johnson and people like that. And, of course, I've just written a book about the Blitz, which is coming out on the 6th of September. And, of course, Al Boley was killed in the Blitz.
Yeah, 1941, I think.
That's right. He was gone. He'd been playing a gig in, I don't know if they called it a gig, but in High Wycombe, because he was trying to sort of revive his career. And they offered him a bed for the night. And, unfortunately, he said, no, he wanted to go back to London. He came back to London, was in his flat in Duke Street, just gone to bed, reading in bed, and a bomb fell and he was killed. So that's
It's terribly sad, because it's such a distinctive voice of that period, really, pre-war, because it was right at the very beginning of the war. So his was really the 1930s music, wasn't it?
Point.
It wasn't so much the sort of victory numbers that became so popular during the war.
No, he's a 30s singer. I think that's how we think of him. Whereas, you know, he wasn't like the Vera Lynns, as it were, of the Anne Sheltons of the later period.
It's fair to say, though, that Al Boley in many ways paved the way for the whole crooner generation, which encompassed Bing Crosby and, of course, latterly Matt Monro.
Yes, absolutely. No, absolutely. And, in fact, the whole word crooner was a very, you know, new concept in the 30s. So.
Well, almost as much as a rap artist would probably be at the end of the 90s, really. You know, what's happening here? Dear me, you know, have we seen progress?
And also, I think what was happening again was, I mean, until Al Boley and people like that, the crooners came on, really the stars tended to be the dance band leaders. And it was really only in the 30s that the singers sort of hogged the limelight, because it was people like, you know, Lou Stone and Henry Hall and people like that who were very much the stars of the dance hall circuit. And then, of course, the crooners, and everybody started to fall for the crooners.
'Twas ever thus, I suppose, particularly if they're called Steve. Aaron, over to yourself. Hopefully you're booked in to actually come along to the Reference Library on the 8th of July to touch base with Juliet Gardner. Questions from the Irish perspective.
Hi, Juliet.
Hello.
Hi, I was just wondering, when you were talking, you know, obviously being a chef, interested in food, you know, during the war, and obviously you consulted on the 1940s house, what was the food like where in sort of middle-class to upper-class households?
Well, I mean, everybody, I mean, actually, if you come from Northern Ireland, you did slightly better. And, of course, if you were, I don't know where you come from, but if you came from Southern Ireland, you know, you obviously, you know, you were neutral. You didn't have rationing. But the whole point about rationing was that it was supposed to be equal. Everybody got the same. I mean, regardless of rich or poor, you know, all absolutely got the basics. And the government would only put things on ration that it could guarantee there was sufficient supply of. So sugar and tea and bacon and meat, and then later jam and that sort of thing. But then they would never put, they allocated things like eggs and milk because, of course, they're a little bit seasonal.
Yeah.
And, of course, some things were never on ration. So if you had, but then there was the point system again. But to be honest, it was supposed to be that it didn't matter how much money you've got, you wouldn't eat any better. But we know that that's not true. I mean, we know that if you had money, you know, you could, I mean, you could probably buy things on the black market. You could probably afford to eat in restaurants, and restaurants would get round that by charging a huge amount for the cover or something
like
that.
So,
I mean, well, you know, nothing is ever fair in this life, and rationing wasn't. Though it was the fairest system, I think, a wartime government could devise.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. How did restaurants fare during the war?
Well, there was a lot of bitterness about that because restaurants were supposed to have the amount of rations that, you know, they needed, obviously, for their customers and no more. But then after a bit, it was felt that, you know, by the government that restaurants were really sort of, they were kind of a loophole. So after that, there was a maximum charge. You couldn't charge more than 5 shillings and you couldn't have more than a certain number of courses and you couldn't have meat and fish and this sort of thing. But as I say, I mean, the posh restaurants like the Savoy or the Ritz did seem to manage to get round it pretty well. If you read people's memoirs, you'll find they, you know, they managed to eat pretty well even during the war. But then, of course, the government set up what were known as British restaurants. Well, that was a great idea because that was for working people, and it did help on the rations because, again, the meals were cheap. I think they were sixpence or a shilling in some cases, and you know they'd be pretty simple fare. But you know, it did ensure that people who were working away from home did get a decent meal, and then there were all the canteens and things that were set up for war workers and all that sort of thing. So communal feeding was a bit more of a thing in the war than we have today.
There's always a way. It has to be said, actually. I was just having a George Formby moment because as we've been speaking, the siren windows have been cleaned with effortless skill and style, really. That shows quality, really. Judith, any other questions you'd like to put to Juliet?
I suppose if you were doing, you know, dressing a set for that period, you'd have to be very careful not to put a bowl of fruit on display with things like bananas in it.
Exactly, absolutely. No, all you could do would be have sort of, you know, an ox's apples off your tree because most people hadn't seen a banana after about sort of 1940,
Juliet,
41.
Yes, we have no bananas.
We have no bananas. And oranges, of course, if any oranges were around, arrived, you know, the shopkeepers had to offer them to children first. And then if they still had some over, then they could offer them, no doubt, to their sort of favourite customers. Because obviously cross imports, I mean, were very treacherous. They had to come across the Atlantic with all, you know, the U-boats, the Battle of the Atlantic going on. So it's not, and also, of course, the ships were needed to carry war material and troops and things. So it's not really surprising, but I always think it must have been, most people, nobody starved, I don't think, during the war, but it must have been an awfully boring diet, called for an awful lot of ingenuity from housewives.
And it makes, you know, our post-banking disaster austerity budget days seem not quite so bad, really, I feel, you know, in the light of all manner of things. Sue?
Well, I was just wondering, I mean, I was listening with great amusement about the restaurants and the supplies that they would have, because my family historically have been butchers.
Oh.
And throughout the war, the stories were also always told that, you know, the meat comes in, you don't ask where it comes from during the war.
No
because
questions asked.
As long as it's fresh, it's going to be edible. So all those sorts of the things were brought up as you were saying that. But I was wondering, if you were to think forward, like in 60 years' time, and one of these shows were to be put on, possibly on a sort of a hologram or something like that, the 2010 house, what sorts of things, you know, history has a way of sort of picking out the bits that it wants to show. What sorts of things do you think would be relevant from today?
Oh, that's a great question, isn't it? Well, I think what we've just said about, somebody's just said about flat pack furniture, I think that would be one of them. Big televisions, I think that would be another thing, because in every home there seems to be a large television. I think gardens would be very interesting and distinctive, because, I mean, if you think 20 years ago, I mean, most gardens were a lawn and herbaceous borders. Now we've got sort of patios, crazy paving, but, you know, all this decking and water features and all that sort of thing. And I think the food, the variety, the range of food we eat nowadays would be absolutely, I mean, it won't be amazing in the future, of course. Oh, well, who knows? I mean, maybe they'll eat just little powdered pills in the future. We don't know. But, you know, that certainly is what, it's very hard, isn't it, to think what it's going to be, what's going to stand out to people in the future. I mean, what now stands out to us, what really surprises us about 60 years ago was obviously seemed perfectly normal to people then. So it's very hard to know, but I do think that...
I think possibly people driving in cars using petrol would be a good one to put forward.
Maybe, yes, maybe. And, of course, people still on bicycles, I suppose. I mean, nowadays, yes, I mean, which all, I think one of the things that is interesting is the sort of, not only the changes, but the continuity. I mean, obviously, you know, we all talk, you know, we all think, you know, people are eating asparagus and aubergines and things like that, but they're also still having shepherd's pie and fish and chips, you know, and people are going around in cars now, in diesel cars and things like that, but they're also, there's a great revival of things like the bicycle and things like that. And so I think it's a really interesting mixture of what is absolutely, you know, seems cutting edge, and what seems just a continuity and just an adaptation of what's always, you know, what makes sense, as it were.
Although one has to add, Juliet, if you're thinking of actually getting on your bicycle and cycling up to Middlesbrough, I'd suggest you need...
Far.
Yeah, just a touch. I think 250 miles, you just need to think a little bit about that.
Start off in good time, you'd say.
Very true. Actually, yes, Thursday the 8th of July, well worth, you know, if you set off now, all will be well from that. Exactly. And she's obviously research fellow at the Institute of Historical Research, editor of History Today. We've already mentioned that. Juliet, it's been absolutely wonderful just sharing some time with you today. Malcolm, would you like to throw those last two questions to Juliet Garner, please?
Yes, Juliet, have you enjoyed your chat with us this evening?
Oh, very much, yes. It's a nice curtain raiser for the festival itself, and I'm much looking forward to it. I have to confess, I have never been to Middlesbrough, so I'm really looking forward to coming.
We shall look forward to seeing you there.
I can sense a whole new series of documentaries coming out just from your experience going up to Middlesbrough. Did you manage to get to Redcar when Atonement was being...
Unfortunately, that's the one place I didn't manage to get. Oh. I would love to have come to that. I was really... the timing just didn't work, I think. So I was really sorry. I gave that, you know, I talked to a lot about, you know, the military and all that sort of thing, because I was very interested in it, but I know I didn't get it. I wish I had, but maybe I'll be able to rectify this time.
Precisely. So the next question, Malcolm, is...
Will you come back and talk to us again sometime, Juliet?
Of course I will. Absolutely. I'd be delighted.
Juliet Garner, publisher, academic, full-time author, in general, Renaissance woman, it has to be said, for the 21st century. We salute you. See you very soon.
Thank you.
Whatever I sing, that's what I really mean.